From Studio J, 10 stories above K Street, this is the Education Gadfly Show.
This is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my special co-hosts, Liam Julian and Kobe Loop. Welcome, Liam and Kobe.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Yes, that is right, everybody. We have special guests, and that is because, as you recall, Rick is out in Chicago this week at the American Education Research Association meeting. But don't fear, he does have a report from the field. Rick, how's Chicago and AERA?
Michael J., I am talking at you live from AERA, baby. I'm out here. We're having a scholarly good time. We're imbibing lots of scholarly research, and on the whole, it is just what we call an academic occasion, baby.
Wow.
This is something us PhDs do together. I don't know if you'd really be up on this.
Oh, that's right. No, no. Those of us with bachelor's degrees, we could not possibly understand the research that was being presented there today. So Rick, do you get any glares from people for making fun of the research that they're producing there at AERA, as you did in the Gadfly last week?
Well, you know what I tell them? I say, hey, it's all with love, baby. I'm like, would you rather have me, one of their own, here prodding them to, you know, make sure that they don't have silly people embarrassing the good ed research, or would they rather have people on the outside peeing into the tent? I don't know if I'm actually convincing anybody. But it seems to make good sense to me.
So,
yeah, I've gotten a couple of ugly looks.
Nice. So Rick, who is the most famous researcher that you've seen downing a beer there in Chicago?
Well, let's see. We were just chilling with the famed Gary Orfield. Before that, we were chilling with the famed David Berliner, whose new book, Collateral Damage, is selling like hotcakes over to Harvard Education Press.
Yes.
We were laughing about, I don't actually disagree with David, apparently. I'm mostly just envious that his books are outselling my books by a factor of like 2,300 to 1. But such is life. We have the commissioner of NTS, Mark Schneider, out here. We have the famed David Francis. It's just a good old research time.
That's good. You can all come together and share ideas and share a beer and have merriment. That's great.
It is a beautiful cumbia moment. I got to say that I'd encourage everybody to take up their own little piece of AERA heaven.
Very good. All right, Rick. Well, we're going to miss you on the rest of the show today, but please send our Education Gadfly love to those education researchers out there.
You got it. And now is young Kobe capably filling in?
Young Kobe and young Liam are going to do what they can to help the Education Gadfly show go ahead and move forward.
Gentlemen, God bless you all.
All right, Rick, we'll see you in studio next week. Have fun out there.
All right, bud.
So what do you think, Liam? You think Rick's already had a few to drink today?
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like this is what these research conferences are really all about.
Chicago's kind of that kind of city, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just assume that Rick's already had a few to drink pretty much at all times.
Yes. Yeah, not before the show. We have a strict no drinking policy
that's
Education
true.
Gadfly show. That's right, which we should probably break. We might be more entertaining that way. Okay, well, we are going to get going here today. We're going to start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly, and both Liam and Kobe are going to participate in different parts of that game. We're really trying something new here. Then we are going to have an interview with our own in-house Gadfly, the one and only Chester E. Finn Jr. And finally, our in-house weirdo Liam will impart some education news of the weird. So let's do it. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. 3 topics for 90 seconds each. Liam, start us off.
Topic 1. Kobe, Fordham just released a report that seems to show that public school principals are largely okay with their lack of autonomy. What's the deal with that?
I think I'm going to defer to Mike on this one.
You know, Kobe, you copy-edited that report 5 times. I think you should have a good answer about this, but we'll get back to you. All right. So this is a really discouraging, although perhaps not terribly surprising, is that public school principals learn to accept the system as it is. You can understand that. They have to work in this system every day. If they were real change agents that demanded greater autonomy and authority, then they'd probably leave the public education system and go start a charter school. Instead, they find ways to work around the barriers, and many of them do a great job working around barriers, getting to know people in the district office or, you know, finding different tricks of the trade to get good teachers into their schools and likewise. And they deal with what they have to deal with. I mean, Kobe, does that sound like a reasonable approach, or should we be angry at principals for not demanding more autonomy?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's hard because there's obviously the system around them is, you know, pretty well entrenched. So what can they do about it? I mean, what do you think they can do about it, Mike?
Well, that's the question, is whether or not these principals could, for example, push back on teacher union contracts that they don't like or central district policies that basically give them little authority over their staff or their budgets or their curriculum. I mean, you know, is that a fair expectation for mid-level managers, which is basically what a lot of these principals are, to try to come together and to push some of those changes in terms of being reformers? I think at the end of the day, that's probably an unfair expectation. But what's important to know is that a lot of the new principal training programs, like New Leaders for New Schools, they're trying to get these top-notch people who are used to having authority as leaders in other fields, and they're sending them into the public education system. You know, and I'm worried that those people are going to quickly get frustrated when they find out they don't have control over things like staffing. And so, you know, that's another argument for expanding the charter sector, where at least principals really do have authority over key parts of their school.
Good answer.
Nice monologue.
Oh, there's the bell. Alas.
Yeah, you know, I really had to pick up some slack there from Kobe. Kobe, it's okay. You're allowed to have your own opinions. This is the Education Gadfly Show. You can disagree with me.
Well, usually around the office, I'm not. They're stamped out. So
that's true.
This is a change for me.
Well, now, is Kobe going to resist his lack of autonomy in the office, or is he just going to accept it?
That's an excellent question. I think that was just a sign that Kobe had, unfortunately, has come to accept the lack of autonomy that he has.
I'll try harder. All right.
I think
I'm going to read the second one, and then Liam will answer, right? The New York Times reports that a city in Westchester County has decided to confront the achievement gap by pulling black males out of class and giving them separate instruction. Discipline problems are declining, and black male high school students are taking tougher classes. Should we applaud this approach?
No, we shouldn't. I mean, first of all, the article is interesting because the program is relatively new. So there's no real test score data that can say whether or not this approach is actually working. But we do know that discipline problems for the younger black students, black male students, is leveled off, and that the older black male students are taking harder classes. But what is the means to justify that end? I mean, we're essentially segregating kids out of their classes. It's a little bit, I guess...
scary.
Well, it's scary, but it's also unfortunate that the district is thinking about also making this program or making a similar program for Hispanic males as well.
All right. So you don't like the idea that we are basing so many judgments just on the color of these kids' skin, right?
Well, I mean, the big problem here is doing that at all. And NCLB almost incentivizes that by the way that they disaggregate the data by race. It'd be really nice if NCLB would use more growth model approaches for individual students and go about their sort of sanctions and
right. So you focus on kids who are behind regardless of the color of their skin.
Right.
All right, that's fair. And I understand that you just have an ideological or philosophical problem with any of these programs that divvy us up by race, so to speak. Right. So, but the question is, Liam, you know, this is a voluntary program, so parents aren't forced to have their kids participate in it. And by all accounts, the kids are enjoying it. Maybe it's successful. So, you know, you could argue, who are we to say that, you know, if this program is working and the people involved like it, you know, that we should be arguing against it?
Yeah, but what kind of message does that send? I mean, what kind of message does it send to the participants that, you know, that they have to be separated from the rest of their class and get, you know, separate instruction? You know, they're going to wonder why, and it's because they're black and because they're male.
Yeah. Liam, do you ever wonder why we separate you from the rest of the office?
I haven't actually.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get to that later. All right. Topic number three, Liam, starts off.
Yeah. Topic number three. Kobe, Sandra Stotsky of the Massachusetts Board of Education writes in this week's Gadfly that all future elementary school teachers should have to pass a relatively rigorous math test. Is this smart policy or another unnecessary barrier to the teaching profession?
Well, when it comes to the math and reading and you want to put national standards, everyone seems to think, you know, that's just fine because how much debate can there be over math and reading? Those are basic skills. But as far – well, I've been at Fordham. I've observed the math wars, the reading wars. It just doesn't seem as simple as everyone makes it out to be. Is it, Mike? Because it just doesn't seem that way to me.
Kobe, I don't think you actually just said anything right there. But that's okay. I know you're still new. You're still new at the show here. All right. The fundamental question is this. You know, is subject matter knowledge so important that we should have some somewhat arbitrary measure to figure out whether teachers should be in the classroom? I mean, what if there's a teacher who's just fine at teaching math, but for one reason or another, he or she just can't pass his test, right? Maybe they're bad at taking the test. Maybe they don't actually need to know as much math as is on this test, but they can still teach their first graders, you know, basic arithmetic. So, you know, what – that's the real trade-off here, right? I mean, do we want to give school principals, you know, carte blanche to decide who is qualified to teach and say, look, if they're getting results, then we don't care about their credentials? Or is this a real effort to raise standards in order to raise student achievement? So, Kobe, where do you come down on that? Do you like the idea that teachers should have to pass a test, a tough test or not?
Well, you know that I'm usually against any nationally imposed
tests. This isn't national. This is at the state level. This is Massachusetts.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that you would want to test your teachers to make sure they know a baseline of content. But the question is the political process going to be able to produce the right test, or are they just going to come out with some jumbled test that everybody is going to, you know, be criticizing the second it comes out?
All right. But in this case, it looks like Massachusetts has actually succeeded in putting in place a very difficult test, which is different than most states.
So, well, then that's another problem.
Actually going to be people failing this test, not being able to teach because they don't know enough math. And what if some of those teachers might have been good teachers?
Well, I totally agree. Usually I would say that you should give the principals the, you know, authority to do whatever they want. But then we have the question again: if the principal isn't prepared to take advantage of that level of autonomy, I mean, are they going to be able to, you know which math teachers to hire?
Very nice, Kobe. That was a nice way to tie it in with the first topic.
I'm a quick learner.
That was good. All right. Well, I think that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Nicely done.
That was great. Thanks.
All right, quite a thrill. Doing what we can here. You know, Rick leaving us. Mr. Missing in Action. It just doesn't sound so good with that cell phone. We just couldn't have him on the show calling in from the bar, you know?
Yeah.
Just too much ambient noise. All right. Well, coming up next, we have an interview with Chester Finn. Let's take a listen. Joining us in the studio today is the original Education Gadfly, Dr. Chester E. Finn Jr. Checker, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here, and if I knew how to make biting noises, I would.
Good. What does that mean?
That means that gadflies are supposed to bite.
Oh, I see. Good.
Like,
all right. Well,
caimans and tarantulas and other wild creatures.
Well, speaking of wild creatures, I understand that you are back from the Amazon. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that and how it relates to education reform?
We visited two schools in very, very poor villages along the banks of the river. We didn't stay long. It was hot and sweaty, and we left a very small personal contribution behind, but one of them didn't have a teacher weeks into the school year, and the other had a brand new and very earnest teacher dealing with essentially a one-room schoolhouse of kindergarten through, let's say, eighth grade, and dealing with kids who were mostly supposed to be out fishing for their living and doing other things besides going to school. It was actually pretty interesting. But the main purpose of the trip, to be honest, was part of seeing the world. And the Amazon's one of the more interesting places in the world that I had always wanted to see. And indeed, it is.
Is it true that you wrestled a 5-foot anaconda with your bare hands?
I had a 5-foot anaconda that was closer to me than you are now, and I could have touched it. But some red ants were biting it, and it chose to swim away instead of swim to me.
Okay. Well, speaking of that kind of conflict, like we see in nature, we're going to talk about conflict today in the Buckeye State, in Ohio, where, of course, Fordham spends half of its time and energy. There's a new governor in town. He wants a moratorium on charter schools, and he's proposed some other things that are not so great for charter schools either. What's the lesson from all of this, and what do you take of it?
Well, he's proposed a moratorium on charter schools, and he's also proposed to eliminate the voucher program that Ohio only got enacted a year or so ago. And he is dead set against every form of school choice that I know about, in spite of the fact that Achieve and McKinsey and Sir Michael Barber just a few weeks earlier recommended a far more comprehensive approach to school choice in Ohio. The governor's going in exactly the opposite direction and behaving very badly. But let me also say that the school choice crowd in Ohio is behaving badly. They are declining to acknowledge that there are low-performing charter schools and irresponsible sponsors, and fundamentally they are just on a political campaign to, quote, save our choice, just like it is, apparently, without taking advantage of what could be an opportunity to reform and strengthen the program. I hope that's what comes out of it before the legislature's done, but if that's what comes out of it, it'll be because the legislature did it.
Okay, so if this is an opportunity to, let's say, try to get rid of some of the bad charter schools and help the good charter schools, what are some of the key policies to do that?
A kind of a house cleaning of low-performing charter schools and a much stepped-up accountability system for sponsoring organizations. Ohio now has dozens and dozens of sponsoring organizations. We at the Fordham Foundation are one of them, but there are lots. And a bunch of them, honestly, are not doing a good job of monitoring their schools. And the sponsoring organizations, in turn, are actually not accountable to anybody. Nobody is watching their performance and pulling the plug on bad sponsors, just as sponsors are supposed to pull the plug on bad schools. So there are a couple of steps that could be taken here. Actually, there was an elaborate report presented about 5 months ago by Fordham and the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools and the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, all working together on a set of policy proposals for Ohio for strengthening the charter program there. And those were great proposals. A couple of them were adopted by the legislature during its lame duck session in December, but most of them have been ignored so far.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time, but in a sentence or two then, what's the key takeaway for the national charter school movement? What can we learn from all of this in Ohio?
Clean up your own act and police your own troops, or people you don't like at all are going to come in and try to do it to you and do it worse. When you get an opportunity to make lemonade out of a political lemon, which is, I think, Governor Strickland, squeeze it and add sugar and stir.
Well said. Thank you, Chuck, for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
So, Kobe, do you agree that we should squeeze Governor Strickland like a lemon?
Definitely, if not harder than a lemon. I mean, what's with this guy?
Ah, interesting. Liam, your thoughts?
Yeah, somewhere. I come down somewhere in between. maybe some other type of fruit.
Liam's afraid to incriminate himself on air.
That is wise. That is very wise. Okay, well, it is time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian, putting on his news of the weird hat now. Liam, what is weird this week?
Well, Mike, it looks like the faculty of the University of Florida is getting more than it bargained for. After denying an honorary degree to former Sunshine State Governor Jeb Bush, an amendment that just passed the Florida House Schools and Learning Council would name UF's Ed School the Jeb Bush College of Education. Jeb's spokesman said the former governor was glad that his legislative allies are still thinking about him, but that he'd rather not have his name on the building. Public servants, according to Jeb, should eschew such honors. Plus, most buildings are only named after politicians once those politicians are dead.
Wow. See, yeah. I love this story. Now, and I know that, the Jeb didn't really, that doesn't really care one way or the other, but it's pretty funny. I mean, you know, this is a real affront to the Ed schools down there. And I think we should do something similar. Let's say Arizona State University, where David Berliner is, Rick mentioned that his anti-testing book is selling like hotcakes. I think it would be pretty funny, you know, to have, a well-known proponent of testing be on the name of that school too. I mean, just for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm. Just to enrage those that disagree with us.
Just to enrage. That's right. I mean, I guess it's more telling. You know, recently Congress voted to rename the Department of Education building here in Washington the Lyndon Baines Johnson building.
That makes sense.
That makes sense. That's right. That's right. You know, there was certainly a lot of people upset when the National Airport was renamed after Ronald Reagan, you know, because, of course, he had fired all of the air traffic controllers back in the day. Right. So perhaps this is somewhat similar.
But I think he liked flight.
He liked flight. Yeah. I see. He was generally supportive of aviation.
Of all sorts.
Yes.
Birds, planes.
Automobiles. Oh, that's not flight.
Close.
Okay. Well, so Jeb Bush, so we'll have to track this. He doesn't want his name on it. So is this it? Are they going to drop it?
Some people also think that apparently this is a bad idea. It's going to set a bad precedent because from now on, all governors are going to want their names on buildings.
If you were to have your name on one building, is there any one building you would like it to be on?
What about that big obelisk downtown here? They got a name for that already?
Ah, Liam. See, I think you were out at the beach on the day in history when they studied that. That's a good idea. All right. You would like a phallic symbol named after you, is what you're saying. Okay. Thanks. All right, everybody. Well, if you made it this far, we deeply appreciate it. And we will be back next week with Rick in the saddle. Till then, I'm Mike Petrilli.
I'm William Julian.
I'm Kobe Loop.
All of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation signing off.